What do you make of the exit poll, John McDonnell?
Well, if the seat tally comes out that way, it's going to be extremely disappointing, of course it is. Yes.
Well, spoiler alert, it held. Hi, everybody. This is Justin Robert Young for Politics, 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 the December 13, 2019 edition of the program. Hello. Huge news out of the UK politically. We have a massive, massive blowout for the Conservatives. It was so big, I had to call Tom. I had to have an emergency a meeting with Tom. We did the BX3 stuff on Wednesday. I had to bring him back to talk about this because, man, I don't normally pay attention to UK politics this closely, but I was learning all those little towns and stuff. They got such silly names. I don't even know what the hell it means, but I do know this. Boris Johnson just cobbled together the largest Conservative Party majority since Margaret Thatcher. Jeremy Corbyn's career as the head of the Labour Party looks to be at an end, and we have so much more with Tom on that. We also have an interview all about tariffs. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but on these Friday episodes, what I like to do is give you a big helping of, like, smart stuff. Because I know you got a few extra days. You don't have to blast through it all at once. I want this to be your, like, nice Sunday relaxing kind of thing. Your Saturday relaxing kind of thing. So I'm trying to get this episode out a little bit early. So spoiler alert, if you're looking for news that happened on Friday, normally I do it on Friday, but I'm doing this on Thursday night because I got some travel here. So, interview about tariffs, interview about the Brexit results. I mean, geez, of the election results, but it might as well have been the Brexit results, considering the fact that that was really what everybody voted for. In the meantime, I was hoping that by the time that I recorded this, I would be able to have the official sound of the Judiciary Committee approving the articles of impeachment, but oh my good God, they are still droning on. It is pushing toward 10 o'clock, and literally everybody involved has just gone and on 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 and on. That's going to happen tonight, even if it is, you know, late into the night. They're going to take a vote that everybody knows what the results are going to be, and it's going to be on party lines, and then it's going to get sent to the House, and then I'm going to predict that it's happening on Wednesday of next week, that the House will vote on it. Right. And I'm predicting at this point, according to current reporting, that about 6 Democrats will not vote for it, which, by the way, would be 4 more than the 2 that didn't vote for it initially. And the only other house-wide vote that was taken on this. And then it's going to go to the Senate. And then because this is a life-changing constitutional crisis that needs to be dealt with immediately, the Senate's going to take Christmas break. So, of course, I mean, come on. They're not insane. They're not monsters. They're not Grinches, right? Of course. I mean, yes, this is an absolute once in a generation. You need to stop this tyrant in his tracks problem. But also, bells will be ringing. The sad, sad news. We will push off impeachment. And so they're going to come back in January, and then I'm going to predict this. I'm throwing this out there. I haven't even looked at a calendar, right? I haven't even looked at a calendar. Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to say it's January 13th. January 13th, there's going to be a vote, and that's going to be on party lines. And Donald Trump, by way of Mitch McConnell's handling of this, will be acquitted. This is the new strategy by Cocaine Mitch. He's going to acquit Trump, not just dismiss the charges. He's going to acquit it. Now, functionally, it means the exact same thing, but they want to put more of a basket of ammunition in Trump's hands, and so they're going to do it. And so by January 14th, all of the senators that are currently running for president, up to and including Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren, so, you know, 3 Democrats that the Democratic Party cares about, and Bernie Sanders. We'll go back to Iowa, and hopefully by that point, Biden hasn't punched a dude, and there's been no other report that Pete Buttigieg consulted for the Death Star when he was working with McKinsey. And so that's what's going to happen. I hate to spoil it, because, boy, I love unfolding this story just one origami tab at a time. But I'm telling you right now, just because I'm pressed for time. So there we go. I've spoiled the next 2 months.
Politics.
I would like to welcome back our UK correspondent, live and direct from Los Angeles, California. Tom, what the hell happened?
It turns out that Brexit really was the only issue that people in the UK cared about. And Boris Johnson and the Lib Dems were both right, but Boris Johnson was more right about what they thought about it. And the Conservatives have just run the table. I mean, it sounds like, you know, the results that are coming in are matching the exit polls, and we're going to have 5 years of Boris Johnson. Well, hopefully for the Conservatives, Boris Johnson as the prime minister.
So let's go ahead and break that down. This is a blowout, the likes of which we have not had in a very long time. This is the largest Conservative majority that has been seen in the UK since Margaret Thatcher. Boris Johnson has done not only what Theresa May was unable to do in terms of this Brexit thing, but really David Cameron or any other Conservative leader before him. This is a massive mandate.
Yeah. Labour's shadow chancellor, John McDonnell, told the BBC, "I thought it'd be closer."
All right. So
it says it all.
So let's go back to some of the threads that we had left from Wednesday. This definitely means that exactly what Boris wants on Brexit is going to happen, right?
Yeah. We will probably see the legislation for the exit, which was the holdup. The deal was approved, but the legislation to enact it was where the conflict came in. We will probably see that done by Christmas, and then have an exit in January. So 31st of January would probably be the next time that we'll have will be the next available opportunity for them to really have the Brexit happen. But we'll get the legislation to make that happen on January 31st. So for the first time, it looks like we will have a date for an actual Brexit that will in fact actually happen.
But then beyond that, this seems to be like a gigantic weapon also for the negotiations that we were talking about on Wednesday that are definitely going to be a lot stickier. But if he's got an 80 seat cushion, That leaves a lot of room.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it doesn't make the task any easier.
No,
certainly.
Yeah.
But having majority rule means he's not going to have to do anything but work within his own party. Now, granted, there are a lot of folks within the Conservative Party that were rebelling against things that Boris Johnson was doing. But I think now that they've got a majority, he won't have to try so hard to, you know, wave the flag of a hard exit, and the Conservatives can all kind of just fall in line behind him easier, and so you'll probably see some folks welcomed back into the fold. That's already happened to a large extent, and it takes the pressure off because they know we have 5 years in rule. We're not going to have to go have an election. Now, I say that anything's possible. You could have strife within the Conservative Party over the trade deal, but the trade deal is the next thing. And you've got a couple years to do that as well. It's not impossible that, you know, we see Groundhog Day return in a couple of years, but this takes the pressure off of a lot of things and a lot of people right away.
But it also gives Boris Johnson a tremendous negotiating lever, because now the EU is not going to be looking back at him and saying, you sure? You sure you can even get this done in your own party? You sure that?
Yeah.
You sure that, no, that you don't want to hedge on this a little bit?
Well, and honestly, they could now change things that are in the current deal for the trade deal. So the current deal just says these are going to be the rules of the road after you're gone while we negotiate a full deal.
Yeah.
They could go and change the Irish deal, and the DUP couldn't do anything about it at this point because they are no longer supplying those votes that the Conservatives need.
So this is a huge win for the Conservatives. As it turns out, of course, success has many fathers and failures an orphan, but the strategy for Boris Johnson to run on a fairly plain get Brexit done platform combined with who we will talk about now, Jeremy Corbyn's strategy of, boy, are the conservatives mean and they're going to dismantle the NHS, did not seem to animate voters.
Yeah, as much of a victory for the conservatives as this is, and like you said, biggest conservative victory since 1987, it is a much worse loss for Labor. It's Labor's worst result since 1935. And it was something that shouldn't have been a surprise, I don't think, when you see the Lib Dems saying, well, we're gonna push for Remain. Maybe we can still get Remain done. It wasn't a bad strategy. I think they did pick up one seat, but they certainly didn't fall apart worse than they had been. The Conservatives won their majority partly because Boris Johnson picked the right message. You're tired of Brexit. Let us get it over with.
Yeah.
I think that resonated with the entire country.
He also was very careful to not say anything stupid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Him and his girlfriend kept their voices down for a month.
Yeah, everything was under wraps for the period of the election. But also Labor gave him a gift by not focusing on we can do Brexit better. That would have been a possible strategy that could have won for Labor, is to go head to head, say, yeah, the Lib Dems are saying remain, but honestly, you know, that's a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. We can do it better. We can keep us in a customs union. They could have brought some Remain people over to be like, well, you're right. We're probably going to leave. Let's leave on better terms. That would have been a potentially winning message for Labor. They didn't use it.
Well, at least it would have been coherent.
So they gave a gift to Boris Johnson.
Yeah, it would have been understandable. You know, when, you know, my Twitter feed in the morning, which by and large are Labor voters, are talking, it's all videos of Steve Coogan talking about how mean the Conservative Party is. That doesn't win an election. The other guys are mean, doesn't win, especially when you're dealing with something as consequential as Brexit.
And certainly the downside to Labor having taken that strategy would have been, well, these folks have a deal. You're wanting to change the deal again. But that would have brought some people over to like, yes, I want it done, but I want it done right, who are probably voting conservative because they just want it done. And I'm talking specifically about those folks in the Midlands and Wales.
And that's, you know, the biggest problem here in my mind is that following this Brexit negotiation stuff, all of the action was within the Conservative Party. It was the Conservative Party that couldn't get their ducks in a row under Theresa May. It was the Conservative mm-hmm. Party that was shuffling their leadership. It was the Conservative Party that had selected Boris Johnson. It was the Conservative Party that had its own members leaving because they didn't like the deal that Boris Johnson had and they were going to afraid that it was going to be rammed through. The Labour Party, from an outsider's perspective, which on one hand, what the hell do I know? On the other hand, at least I know enough that I can pick up broad strokes of what the strategies are. The Labour Party seemed to be, some of us are for it, some of us are against it. We'll figure it out. And yeah. I don't think we'll figure it out was a compelling message.
I think one of the telling results is Blythe Valley, which has never had anything but a Labour MP. It was created in 1950, so it's not one of those constituencies that's been around forever. But conservatives took it. They took a constituency that Labour should always just count as safe. That's telling right there. You're not going to win, and you're not going to stay in charge of your party, furthermore, if you can't keep seats like that.
Is this the death knell of the Jeremy Corbyn leadership of Labour?
Yes. No matter, you're not going to hear anybody say that yet. I think the closest was John McDonnell, again, the shadow chancellor for Labour, telling Andrew Neil at the BBC that decisions will be made about the party leader's future when the actual results are in.
Yeah.
But I think that's pretty fair to say he's done. There's no way that the party is going to continue to have faith in him when he has led it to its worst results since 1935.
And I think just in general, they need a fresh coat of paint. Like, this is a different world, this post-Brexit world, or the process of Brexiting world, is, you know, I think would benefit from a fresh perspective.
I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was the fresh perspective.
Another
right?
like, another fresh perspective.
Yeah.
Just it's, not it's like, this guy.
Let's get an even fresher coat of paint. He's only been in the role for 4 years. He took over after Ed Miliband sort of it was thrown under the bus in a way because of poor showings. Nothing has been solid for Labour since Gordon Brown, and that's saying something. So it's time for soul searching for Labour. They had a brief, you know, a few months under Harriet Harman, both before Ed Miliband and after, just as an acting chairman. But otherwise, it's been Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband, and Jeremy Corbyn. And Gordon Brown, while he was prime minister, was not considered a terribly successful Labour leader compared to, you know, the Neil Kinnocks and Tony Blairs and Harold Wilsons, et cetera, Clement Attlee. It's not Labour really needs an entire makeover. I don't think they need just a new coat of paint. I think they need a new barn.
So the other big winner, if there is another big winner, is the Scottish National Party. They gained a ton of seats. You had previewed this on Wednesday, but it seems like we are headed to another Scottish independence referendum.
Oh, yeah, because the only place that it seems like the Conservatives lost seats were in Scotland to the SNP. And that's going to happen. There is going to be another referendum on Scottish independence, and it is not going to be as clearly remain in the UK as it had been. Now, I don't think it's a lock, as I do with Jeremy Corbyn leaving the Labour Party leadership. I don't think it's a lock that Scotland leaves. A lot can happen between the time they are elected now and the time they actually get on the ballot, make it happen, get it past the Queen, all of the things that happen to have to happen to set it up. It's not going to happen right away. And by then, so many other conditions will have changed. And whether the Conservatives can persuade Scotland that they're better inside the UK is something that Boris Johnson will have to pay attention to.
The other thing that seemed to be floated is obviously the DUP, the Northern Irish Party, was necessary under the Theresa May gamble because she wasn't able to form a government, and now is an afterthought with such a muscular advantage for the Conservatives. But do you think we could see a United Ireland push?
That's a tougher one. The idea of a United Ireland is so fraught with peril that I doubt that. If we had had worse results in the Irish Compromise on Brexit, maybe. And I wouldn't put off the idea that any future trade pact might show some weaknesses, or this weird drawing the border down the Irish Sea might show some weaknesses. But right now, from what I can tell, and I don't pretend to speak for the Irish, but it seems like people in Ireland don't want anything that's going to make things worse. The way things are working right now is pretty good. You can just drive into Northern Ireland when you need to, and you don't have to show a passport. And in that, if that's going to stay the same, I don't think you see a big sea change. I'm not seeing how the DUP is doing in Northern Ireland right now, so that'll be interesting to tell. My instinct says, Justin, that we're not going to see conditions change in Northern Ireland that much. But what do I know?
Well, and the other thing is, compared to the last Scottish independence question, Boris Johnson is going to have a new trade deal that he can carve out specifically to make the Scottish happy. Right.
Yes.
Like that is an advantage that David Cameron did not have, when it's like, well, you know, I don't know. We'll go to Brussels and we'll don't worry. Things will be cool. We'll just make it cool in Brussels. But now this is going to fully rest on the desk of Boris Johnson.
That'll be a big question, is if he can pull off the reverse magic, right? He pulled off the magic of saying, let me get a deal. Let me get a better deal with the EU. And it's arguably a worse deal from a lot of perspectives, but he got a deal that played better.
Yeah.
Right. And so he was able to assuage problems within his own party to a certain extent, and with his coalition partners. Now he's got a stronger hand to run the government, but he will have to assuage the SNP, and he did it with the DUP barely. Let's see what he can do with a arguably much stronger party and a much stronger point of view, but with more tools in his toolbox.
Well, and we're going to be at the dawning of new trade deals.
Like, that's the tools I'm talking about. Yeah.
That's the big advantage. Is he was able to do what he did with the EU and with the DUP with, you know, when he pulled his pockets inside out, moths flew.
Yeah.
Like, you know, now he actually has stuff he can work with. So a very surprising result.
I would expect to see a lot of debate in the next couple of years over trade deals that treat Scotland differently than the rest of the UK. And is that fair? Is that workable, et cetera? Probably not on the scale of Northern Ireland, of course, because we're not dealing with, you know, a occupied part of a country from the other country's point of view. But there could be some deals where Scotland, he throws a lot of perks Scotland's way that make them feel like they're part of the EU. Although I don't know how much he can do. I don't know how much latitude he has to provide them exceptions, but you're certainly going to try. You're right.
All right, Tom, just one last question here. Scale of 1 to 10. How surprised were you by the results?
It's 2.
No, come on. You did not come on here on Wednesday and say this is going to be an absolute blowout.
No, I guess I'm surprised with the scale. You're right. If you're talking about the scale of it, I'd say 7. But I'm not surprised that the Conservatives won.
No.
I'm not even surprised that they got a majority. I thought that was a pretty decent possibility. And I'm not surprised that Labour imploded. But you're right. The scale of this is surprising to me. It is a much stronger victory than I expected for the Conservatives, and a much worse showing for Labour than I expected.
I don't think anybody, at least that I spoke to, thought that when I woke up this morning, I'd be seeing Steve Coogan videos. And when I am wrapping up during happy hour here on the West Coast, I'm seeing photoshops of Boris Johnson with Margaret Thatcher's haircut.
Yeah. The telling detail for me was when that alert showed up on my phone, like, oh, the polls have closed, right? And then 5 minutes later, I got the next alert. I'm like, okay, here's the early indicator. And it was Conservatives win. That's what I was surprised at. I'm like, wow, that must be big if they already know. Because usually it's like, well, Conservatives trending well, or it looks like we might see a Conservative majority. No, it was like, boom, we knew immediately.
Well, I mean, you have to have
a lot of people saying they voted for Conservative on an exit poll for that to be so definitive.
We were wrapping up and I was like, well, look, the exit poll I'm seeing here from Sky News is plus 80. And you were like, wait, like
80?
80, the majority? Yeah. Like, or 80, like how on earth?
Let's just keep using unprecedented till it's meaningless. This is an unprecedented victory for the Conservatives.
And also a bit of a completion of a political resurrection for Boris, right?
Yes, it
like,
is.
He yeah. was somebody that was thought to be kind of a castaway that the sins of the Remain or the Leave vote had kind of tanked him. And now here he is, you know, the most powerful Conservative prime minister since Thatcher.
And he will have to now prove that he can govern in a non-crisis situation.
Yeah.
That's going to be the challenge for Boris Johnson after 5 years, if he wants to remain prime minister, is can I prove that I can do it over the long haul, not just wade in with the bluff and bluster to face all my enemies down? He's shown he can do that for sure.
All right. Tom, at Ace Detect on Twitter. Is there anything else we want to get out there? I know you restarted the Daily Tech News Show newsletter, right?
Well, I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I haven't quite done it. I sent out a test. But if you want to take part in my beta tests for a possible 2020 relaunch of the Daily Tech News Show newsletter, go to freetechnewsletter.com.
Look at that. All right. Thank you, Tom.
You bet.
Politics. A reminder, if you want to support this podcast that is going on the road in 2020, we're doing Iowa for sure. We're doing Nevada for sure. We're doing California for sure. We're doing Florida for sure. But if you want me to hit New Hampshire, you want me to hit South Carolina, please head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That's where you can support this show. Kick in whatever you want, whatever you feel. Also, if you just want to give me money directly, you can do that too. PayPal.me/JustinRYoung. Also, you can just sign up for my free political newsletter. That's at freepoliticalnewsletter.com. All right, let's go ahead and get into our big brain interview about tariffs. Politics. I am very pleased to welcome our next guest. He is a professor at the University of Chicago in political science and economics. His name is Robert Galluti, and his new book is Narrowing the Channel, The Politics of Regulatory Protection and International Trade. I know it's a weighty issue, but here's what we're going to try to get out of him. We're going to try to get a primer on tariffs. We're going to find out all about the American history of these tariffs. And if we're lucky, we're going to see if we can get a few predictions about this China trade deal, which, again, yesterday was hinted at by the President of the United States of America. We have some very educated guesses. I'm hoping. I have some educated guesses. We'll see if he does. Well, let's ask him right now. Robert, welcome to the show.
Appreciate you having me.
All right. So your specialty is on tariffs, and I really want to get into kind of how they work structurally. So let's start there. What is a tariff?
A tariff is a tax. Essentially, it can be a percentage tax or a fixed tax on international trade. So if you want to sell a good in another country, you have to pay a tax in order to get that good into that other market. These are used by governments to either restrict the level of trade or to raise revenue or to change the composition of trade away from some products and toward others.
Now, where did this originate? Like, where's the beginning of the tariff system?
So it turns out back in the day, it was much harder for kings and local lords or whoever who was in charge of any society to figure out how much money people had hidden in their house or how much money their land was worth. And so things like income taxes or land taxes weren't the way that most governments survived. Instead, what they would do is they would park right outside on the road and they would charge everyone a tax to get into the town or out of the town. So the idea of a tariff, which is essentially a border tax, has been around for as long as we've had cities and communities, because it's much easier to tax something where you can put at a bottleneck rather than having to figure out what's in each person's house and hidden in each person under each person's bed or something like that.
Sure.
So tariffs have been around for forever. And, you know, for the longest time, they were just considered a revenue device, a way of raising funds for fighting wars or paying for the veterans of those wars.
So this seems to be something that comes far more to the fore as international trade becomes more of an economic driver. Would that be correct, or do we have a lot of internation tariffs?
Yeah. So one of the big accomplishments of the U.S. Constitution was to make it so the federal government banned the use of tariffs between the states. But before that, you know, it would cost money to get goods from New York to New Hampshire. So, yeah, turns out that international trade and domestic trade used to be restricted by similar policy instruments. Nowadays, because most countries realize that there are huge economic benefits for having unified markets within their country, they only have barriers outside of their country. And so, yeah, international trade is now where you see tariffs. But even as little as 50 years ago, many societies would have internal taxes. And Canada today still has internal taxes. One of the big wins from the new NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA, is the elimination of a few more tariffs that still existed within Canada for shipping goods from one province to the others.
So in America, are international tariffs, you know, are they there with us from the very beginning? Are we putting taxes on stuff coming in and out, or does that balloon as more international trade becomes bigger business?
The United States has always been a trading country. I mean, from the very beginning, the U.S. colonies were designed to trade with England or with the other European powers. We made, for example, potash, which is basically an input for agriculture. We made cotton, you know, as part of the triangular slave trade. We've always been engaged in international trade in this country, and we've always had tariffs on that trade. And in fact, for most of the U.S. development, we had fairly high tariffs on manufactured goods that would be produced, let's say, in the northern parts of the country, and we'd have relatively low barriers on trade with with our colonial partner, England. Now, over the course, when we freed ourselves from England, it was basically the American Revolution at the very beginning was a fight over taxes, right?
Yeah.
It was a fight over the taxes on foreign tea. I mean, that tea wasn't being made in the United States. And so, it's always been a part of U.S. experience, and it was, for most of America's history, the number one source of revenue besides selling land. So it was the way that the federal government funded itself for the most part until we invented an income tax. So the tariff in the United States has had a long history, and for most of it, the United States was particularly protected.
And so we were protecting our own industries and making money on anybody who wanted to access our markets.
Yeah. It was not just there was a big debate back under Alexander Hamilton era, whether the tariff should be designed just for revenue or to have a protective purpose as well. But for most of the U.S. history, we've had a protective tariff in the sense that there was some point of protecting American industry from foreign competition in addition to raising revenue.
But the revenue was primary. That was the big thing, was just, you know, make sure that we keep the lights on by catching the money coming in.
Well, in the middle of the 1800s, essentially the U.S. It started raising tariffs not just for raising money, but as a way of protecting domestic industry. The idea that manufacturers in the United States could grow up under the protective shield of tariffs was part of Alexander Hamilton's report on manufacturing. It's been a long-standing idea in the American Republic, and something that people like Adam Smith would have disagreed with, but things that has always been part of the American discourse. So it's not just an idea of raising money, but certainly that's where we got our money from, but it was also a way of protecting manufacturers, particularly in the north part of the country. And so for the 19th century, so from the 1800s till about the 1950s, the tariff was the main issue of political division in the United States between the parties besides slavery.
Huh. That was it. That was the dividing line, was exactly how much we wanted to protect our own.
The question was, between the two sides were essentially Southern Democrats who favored free trade and foreign markets for their cotton against Northern manufacturing representatives, mostly Republicans, who promoted a tariff, as well as the Western agricultural interests, who also had a preference for tariffs. So there was a Western and Northern coalition against the South over the question of the tariff, and that shaped U.S. politics and was the main political question for most of America's history.
So when we get to post-Civil War and we continue to see an industrialization of the United States and the international trade continues to grow and grow and becomes a bigger business, is there any shifting in the philosophy from the point of view of the government that you know, these are good or bad, or does one come into favor?
It really depends on who's in power. So whenever the Democrats are in charge, they lower tariffs. Whenever the Republicans are in charge, they raise tariffs. And we have this sort of swing back and forth depending on who's in office, all the way up until the 1950s. So every time you look at the United States and it was under Republican rule, you could be sure that there'd be very high tariffs. And in under the same the next year, if a Democrat came into office, they would try to pass a tariff adjustment to lower the tariffs again. They're always debating about, you know, is it better to raise revenue with lower tariffs or higher tariffs? Because, of course, if you raise a tax too high, then you stop importing and then you don't get any money anymore.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're arguing about what should the nature of American industry be. The U.S. wasn't really a competitive in the manufacturing sector against England until right before World War One.
Oh, okay. So we have two world wars, and then obviously if the 1950s things become more complicated, then that comes at the end of FDR and Truman, right?
So yeah, as soon as World War One comes around, then America enters the global market as a competitive manufacturing power. Before that, we were an agricultural exporter. So we would feed the world and clothe the world in the sense that we would send them the cotton and that it would be manufactured into clothes in England. But we weren't selling like manufactured goods until that point. And so that's when we see the Republicans, who represented all of these manufacturing interests in the North, start shifting away from a position of protection.
And that coincides with Eisenhower, right?
Yeah. So essentially it happens over the course of the 50s. The change in the coalition is gradual. The Republicans continued a relatively protectionist position through that time, but then they changed their platform in 1958.
Aha, uh-huh. And that is for lower tariffs, which would mean more free trade.
At the time, the argument was essentially that we could have negotiations for lowering tariffs at home and abroad at the same time. And it was seen not just as an opportunity for free trade, but as a way of promoting the interests of Europe and defending it against communism. So the Republicans shift away. The Republican shift away from the tariff was not exactly on the basis of just raw material economic interests and the change in their coalitions, but also a set of arguments that were deployed to say this is really what the world needs to survive.
And that if we are going to be a reliable partner on all fronts, economic and militarily, then we want to make sure that they stay strong economically, and therefore we need to strengthen these bonds and make it easier for them to trade into our market.
Exactly. The Democrats never needed convincing on that front, but the Republicans certainly did take advantage of that argument as a way of justifying the switch in position.
And so that comes with the rise of the post-World War II Red Scare and the battle for the globe, right?
And a creation of a set of institutions which enabled the U.S. to govern global trade under a set of rules as opposed to being just what countries unilaterally decide.
And what were those institutions?
So the most important of them was the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, which is now has become the World Trade Organization. And it was founded in 1947 as a way to make it so that governments could essentially back down from mutual protectionism. Essentially, during the 30s, the West and most of the European powers and the big trading powers in the world started raising tariffs against one another. It's sort of like a giant trade war, and this shut off global trade. The people who were in power in the 1940s saw it, such as FDR, argued that this mutual destructive protectionism, these trade wars that existed in the 1930s, exacerbated the political tensions that eventually created the war. And so they thought, as a way to avoid that war, we needed a way of peacefully negotiating lower tariffs, improving commerce between nations, which they believed would improve relations, but also just having a set of institutions where countries could fight without guns and bullets. And so they created this set of rules that would promote global peace and prosperity, they believed, improve global trading relations, and be an alternative to the old systems that countries had for governing global trade. Prior to that, like England would have its colonial sphere, they would trade within that colonial sphere, the U.S. would have its sphere, and those countries raised tariffs to everyone outside of it. And they saw that as exacerbating tensions, so we wanted one system for all countries that would allow us to negotiate and eventually lower tariffs.
So past through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you start to see some technological advancements, obviously, air travel and air trade being among them. What does that do to kind of just global trade in general and then the tariff question specifically?
So global trade has improved in bursts, essentially. There was a huge improvement when we were able to have telegraphs and be able to make orders, which happened in the 19th century. In the 20th century, we saw another boom of global trade after the war ended because we weren't fighting each other and we were all growing a great deal in the 1950s. And the invention of things like airplanes and improvements in eventually cargo containerization, which happened later in the 20th century, massively improved the efficiency of global trade and reduce the costs associated with it. But biggest changes were ability to communicate, allowing you to plan. Because if you think about it, shipping is You're putting your good on a boat. It's going to leave for a while, and you're not going to get paid for it right away. You don't know whether it's going to arrive. You don't know whether it did arrive. And so, like, communication is key when it comes to international trade, and that's definitely improved the ability for countries to trade with one another.
Wow. Okay, that's fascinating. So really, it's like telegraph, telephone, internet are just massive in terms of making sure that everybody can place an order, track an order, and pay for the order.
Yep. And so that, along with a backing down from these tariff restrictions, means that global trade takes off. It's absolutely right. Particularly with the U.S. as the center of a trading relation. So the U.S. is a huge market. Trade is not the largest share of our market the way it is for other countries, but it's still about 20%. It becomes something like 20% of our GDP, and that's a real opportunity to grow. And a lot of growth and innovation comes from the ability to be engaged in global markets.
All right, so that brings us to more of our modern era and some of the modern kind of deals that people would be aware of. Among the ones that are obviously on the tip of everybody's tongue this week, because there is a new version of it, is something like NAFTA. How do these big multi-country trade agreements work in terms of standardizing tariffs?
Okay, so in the United States actually has been planning an agreement with Canada since the 30s. We've been wanting to have a trade agreement with
Canada. We're getting right around to it. I swear, man, we're going to, you know, next week we're going to do it, man.
Yeah. So why did it take 50 years? Well, so the U.S. And Canada and Mexico were eventually part of the World Trade Organization and General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And that's where most of their negotiations happened until the 80s. In the 1980s, the U.S. saw an opportunity to basically strike this deal that we've been waiting for forever to strike with Canada. And the big question was, how would this affect the auto industry associated with the joint supply chain for North America? We saw that there's this huge opportunity to take advantage of the labor costs in Mexico. Also, the costs in Canada were relatively low to the United States for various reasons. And so auto companies were really pushing for a deal to be struck where America could get more exclusive access to these countries. So we signed something called a preferential trade agreement. Now, preferential trade agreements are different than the kind of trade agreements that were developed in the GATT-WTO, in the sense that the GATT-WTO deals were available to everybody who's in the organization. So if you were a member of the WTO or you're a member of the GATT, if any country lowered their tariff, every other country would be able to get access to that rate. It's called the most favored nation rate. In a preferential deal, like the one that we would negotiate with Canada and then Mexico and then create NAFTA in the 90s, only the members of the agreement would be able to get access to that tariff rate. There would be no tariffs between the countries that were participating, but you could maintain whatever tariffs you want to anybody outside. Now, the weird thing about that is while we have harmonization down to zero, actually, on tariffs among the members, the external tariffs are different. So Mexico will have a different tariff to Japan than the United States will have to Japan. This creates weird incentives. You could produce in Japan, you could send a good to Mexico and then try to ship it to the United States. And so the creation of the preferential trade agreement also has to introduce all sorts of regulations for the shipment of goods that will satisfy these low tariff rates. They're called rules of origin requirements. It essentially says goods that are going to get this low tariff that we're going to negotiate between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico have to be produced in one of those countries in order to get access. The rules of origin requirement was designed to exclude, in particular, Japanese auto companies that would be able to use their parts networks from Japan, ship the products to Mexico to be assembled, and then shipped right into the United States for competition with the big three. So a lot of what NAFTA was setting up the rules to prevent that sort of thing from happening and to encourage trade to happen only within the three countries that were at issue.
Which, if you look at the future from that point of the big three automakers and, you know, the relative continued success of the Japanese automakers, it doesn't seem to have done the job that it wanted to do.
Well, it's definitely true that the Japanese companies continued to enter the American market, started producing in the United States, so they're not exposed to the tariff at all, right? So if you produce the Honda in South Carolina, then you don't need to pay the tariff at all. And that was part of the incentive structure that was created with these high tariffs against Japan, is that it just encouraged them to do investments in the United States, hire American workers, which we liked, and also sell lots of cars, which we liked. Now, this wasn't good for the big three. That's true. But the question is whether the big three would be any better off today if they weren't able to take advantage of this this cheap labor in Mexico.
Mm.
It's not clear they would even exist if not for the existence of a unified market in North America.
So then,
if they were stuck for hiring only Americans, there probably wouldn't be an American auto industry.
So then the question becomes, did the deal, which is inherently protectionist, did it keep these companies alive when maybe they should have gone under?
It's possible. I mean, in general, it's a combination of protectionism and opening markets within, right? So it's a protectionist deal in the sense that it's blocking others from gaining access to this open market.
Yeah.
Realistically, the automotive sector was such an important part of U.S. manufacturing. It doesn't make sense from a political perspective that we would just allow it to fail. It's embedded very deeply in a lot of a good part of the American electorate. And to allow it to just die is would be unreasonable.
Gotcha.
From the perspective of a democracy.
Even if they are companies that are flawed or not, you know, improving enough to succeed without the help.
This is a big issue, not just for the question of whether the government's picking winners and losers, but also from the perspective of the environment. If you think about it, anything that helps the automotive industry survive is something that's is continuing the use of automobiles, right, which are terrible for the environment. So there's all sorts of costs to this, but we don't have an alternative in the sense that they're such an important part of the economies, particularly in the Midwest, where it's not just the automotive industries that would go down. There are millions of people that work in affiliated industries, not just people that are selling the cars, but people that are producing all of the advertisements for the cars and producing all the parts for the cars and producing all the doing all the service for the cars. Destruction of the American auto industry would have been devastating to a wide swath of the country. We see now what happens when there are concentrated costs associated with factory closures from the competition with China. And it can be devastating for communities, and those losses don't recover easily.
So let's get into that, because obviously the China question is the biggest in our modern trade conversation. When does China become the economic powerhouse that it is today, and how has our relationship with it changed?
So China was allowed to join the WTO in the sense that we didn't veto their membership, we encouraged their membership in 2002. Prior to that, they had access to the American market through something called permanent normal trading relations, essentially since the late Reagan era. And that was a deal that had to be approved every year by Congress. So all throughout the 90s, China was able to access the American market, but it had to be approved every year by Congress. They had to reauthorize it. Now, when they join the World Trade Organization, they become a full member of the WTO, just like every other member of the WTO, and they get the same promises every other country gets. And that means the U.S. can no longer hold up their continued access via Senate votes. They have permanent access. And this allowed China to massively invest in exporting to the United States and allowed American companies to massively invest in exporting to China. And that really expanded trading relations between the two countries. It was basically starting in 2002 that trade flows between the two countries started really ramping up. And it's been a historic shift in global trading patterns for China's entry into the globe, their growth, and the extent to which that growth affects American companies that were working and producing in those sectors.
And that, I'll, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'll say China's growth and rise is not just a tariff issue. Like I said, they had low tariffs essentially since the 80s from the United States. It also reflects a series of economic reforms that they did within China to essentially adopt a capitalist mode of production for many of their sectors. They've basically eliminated state-owned enterprises in most of the manufacturing sectors. They only have large state-owned enterprises in charge of energy and oil and industries like that, whereas they're allowing private companies to produce in other sectors, including, and this is important, American multinationals. And those American multinationals and Japanese multinationals and Korean multinationals that produce in China are responsible for much of the trade that's entering the United States. So it turns out much of the increase in trade that we've experienced over the last few decades is actually trade governed and run by American and foreign multinationals that are doing business in China, taking advantage of the labor opportunities there.
So in comes Donald Trump, who runs, on a lot of economic anxiety issues, China, and specifically renegotiating a trade deal with China. Among them, I feel like obviously that is something that voters cared about, at least enough to in part put him in the White House. But what does that mean? Like, how do we get, under control or get ourselves in a more reciprocal relationship, to put it in the Trumpian terms, with China?
So right now, what we have is a trade war, in the sense that both countries are raising massive tariffs against one another. We raised something like $250 billion of tariffs against China in 2018. And China raised hundreds of billions of dollars worth of tariffs against the United States. And what this has done is it's dropped the amount of trade between the two countries. But it hasn't created anything like the kind of trade balance that Trump was seeking. Although if we completely cut off trade to zero between the two countries, I suppose it would be balanced.
Yes.
And part of the reason that it hasn't reached balance is because the problem of trade is that you can't just unilaterally decide that we're going to do all the exports and we're not going to import anything. The other country can respond with its own tariffs and its own policies. So it's not clear that, like, just unilaterally we can decide what to trade with China. His hope is that by putting a lot of pain on China, their government will crumble and decide that it's going to have to change its policies domestically and reorient the amount of exports they do to the United States. It's not clear that's going to work, but that did work against Japan in the 1980s. So it's possible that the lesson that Trump drew from that period was that with enough pressure and enough time and patience, eventually there will be a deal such that the trade flows are re-equilibrated.
And so the idea is that we would send at least closer to the same amount of stuff to them that they send to us.
The goal there is, from the perspective of the Trump administration, is to create more of a trade balance in terms of goods flows. Right now we have a balance if you think about both goods and services. But from the perspective of manufactured goods, we import much more than we export to China. And they hope that they could change that fact by encouraging the Chinese state to, for example, buy more U.S. agricultural products. But there's something a little bit strange about the entire enterprise. So there's a kind of a conflict of interests here. To some degree, Trump was arguing that Chinese manufacturing was devastating to the communities in the United States that had to compete with that manufacturing. And that's probably true. It was devastating to those communities. But if the goal is to create a trade balance, it's not necessarily the case that those are the communities that are going to be doing all the exporting to those countries. In fact, the exports tend to come from the coasts. So it's not clear that the communities that he was appealing to are going to be the beneficiaries of any improvement in the trading relations between the two countries. One way to think about that is, in addition, one of the asks of China is that they change their intellectual property provisions.
Yeah.
While that's really great for intellectual property innovators, people that are coming up with the new technologies, those communities aren't the people that were producing those new technologies. Like, you can improve China's openness to American Hollywood movies too. Like, right now they're only allowed to sell a certain number of American Hollywood blockbusters. But is enriching people in LA really what he campaigned on? So it's not obvious to me that the kinds of things that we would actually be able to extract from China in the sense of making concessions are the kinds of things that he was campaigning on, or the kinds of things that benefit the communities that were exposed to import competition from China.
And so those would be Midwest and, you know, Iowa, Michigan, Wisconsin, that kind of stuff.
Right. So, I mean, it's not that those countries don't export at all, but the idea that the problem that they were facing was barriers in China is just not right. In fact, those are the very places that were exporting to China through soybean exports, through airplanes or agricultural equipment, medical equipment. Those are all big exports to the United States to places like China, and they weren't facing that high of barriers in that country. So, again, it's not obvious that the kinds of things that we're going to be able to extract were the kinds of things that we need. The kinds of things we can extract are access to American financial companies or for, again, technology sector companies. But they weren't exactly hurting, and they're not the people that were having to compete with Chinese products in the United States.
And so that is the right now the battle is a raising of tariffs to the point where someone's going to say uncle, right? And then the deal would be, at least from the United States perspective, that the Chinese state agrees to buy more stuff from us, that we get guarantees from them, as well as, like you mentioned before, more access to their movie markets and more protections when it comes to intellectual property. That would be the deal.
Yeah. Now, realistically, they have already made such a deal. The deal that they offered China offered the United States was rejected by the Trump administration, and they were shocked at that rejection. So it's not obvious that actually what the Trump administration wants is a deal. It may just be that they benefit from the fight, showing that they are holding out and pushing for more from the Chinese.
And would that, in your opinion, be partly to just put pressure on Chairman Xi and the current Chinese leadership to try to, you know, maybe damage that hold on control?
It could be but I don't think that the goal of the United States is to disrupt the Chinese leadership. That would be very disruptive from the perspective of U.S. Commercial relations, as well as any prospects of continued, not exactly peace here, but,
yeah,
you know, not getting into conflict. I rather think that this is more of an electoral strategy to say, look, I care for you, the forgotten, silent working man of the United States, and I'm fighting the people that displaced you every day. And if you were to cut a deal, they would have to evaluate whether that deal actually helps them or not. But if he says, no, I'm just continuing to fight because I'm going to get something better, then they can maybe, he can hold out that as a benefit of reelecting him.
So past the election, you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, because I've always operated under the idea that I think, you know, look, the if this fight is indeed, as you said, performative, then ending it with a flourish right before Election Day would be the way to go.
While that would make sense to some degree, I think it would make sense from the, you get this huge economic boom, basically, that would happen immediately. The stock market would reward him greatly for ending the trade war. But it may be that that's not the, not, it depends on the calculations that he wants to make. If I were him, I would end it yesterday, because
yeah,
I think the longer you end it, the more you will benefit from the perspective of the economic growth that will be generated by ending it. But if your goal is the symbolic victory, you could do it right beforehand. If your goal is to show a very small subset of the American people that you're going to continue fighting for them, maybe you wait till after the election.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, because I I do think that the advantage of any incumbent president, you know, beyond Trump, is that you get to do president stuff. And I don't know if there's anything more president stuffy, which is a technical term, than signing a gigantic trade deal with China, at least in 2019 and 2020.
I mean, he can't sign a deal, right?
Yeah.
Because the Constitution guarantees the right to taxation to the Congress. But what he can do is withdraw the tariffs that he has imposed.
Sure.
Any sort of substantial trade deal would require ratification or at least approval by the U.S. legislatures. And there's just no way that they would do that for him.
So, although they did. I mean, you had Nancy Pelosi minutes after talking about the articles of impeachment saying how good the new NAFTA is.
Absolutely. And that's pretty amazing that they were willing to give up the provisions that they were willing to give up to get them to do that. They dropped the demands on biologics, which is incredible because that's what the Republicans were willing to block the TPP over. And they were willing to give up a bunch of concessions on labor, which traditionally the Republicans would have never accepted in a trade deal or any other kind of deal. So it's pretty impressive that they were able to get those concessions, I think. But I don't think that's the size of the deal that would happen if it was a unilateral move by Trump.
Gotcha.
It would be more like the Chinese would agree to buy American agricultural products, make some reforms that they were going to make anyway on intellectual property, and then the U.S. would agree to back down on their hundreds of billions of dollars of tariffs.
I'm sure there'd probably be some kind of photo opportunity, though, right?
You know, oh, absolutely. But, you know, what's better, a photo opportunity where you're shaking hands with the enemies of the United States or you're shaking your fist at them? It's not obvious.
Yeah. I mean, although that does seem to be part of the Trump doctrine is that everybody is your mortal enemy until they're your best friend, even if you're Kim Jong-un. So which is another factor of all this China stuff.
I do think. OK, so I think it would be smart for him to end the deal. Make a deal sometime a few months before the election so that he can have an opportunity to say, look, not only did I fight for you, I got this really great deal out of it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the Chinese state would go along with it. And so, like, it's perfectly available to him. But the any deal that he strikes is not going to make any significant dent on the trade balance. And so he would immediately get all this criticism saying, like, oh, you went through all this work. And we're still selling out the country to the Chinese. I don't know. I think maybe it depends on who the Democrat is, but I could imagine a more left-wing Democrat running to the right of him on this issue.
And saying that...
Saying we needed a harder deal.
Oh, really?
I wouldn't have struck this deal with the Chinese. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be fascinating. I mean, that would be...
Traditionally, for the past 50 years, the Democrats have been the party more skeptical of trade agreements. And so they're in a perfect position to credibly say, I would not sign that deal. I wouldn't.
Well, you know, especially somebody like Bernie Sanders, who was, you know, railing against NAFTA in 1993 and could certainly take that.
Or even Elizabeth Warren has been very skeptical of these pro-corporate trade deals, which they are. And it makes sense that they would be opposed to them.
Well, my guest has been Robert Galluti. Your new book is Narrowing the Channel, The Politics of Regulatory Protection in International Trade, which you can pre-order now. And of course, you are an assistant professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Politics! And that will wrap it up for us today. I want to thank our guests, Tom Merritt and Robert Galluti. I love that tariff interview, man. I love doing these interviews. I hope you guys like them because I love doing it. I love talking to these professors. Know a lot of stuff. I love the context. I just love the history. I don't know. Just feel smarter. Just don't feel like I'm kind of whipping in the wind like a flag during a very, very stiff breeze. That's what it feels like on Twitter, just getting pulled and pushed and then an expert says a thing, then another expert says another thing. I think it's just good to know some of this stuff. Anyhow, I'd like to thank our Titanic $10 tier. Squid's Mixtape, Jamie, Ryan, Adam, Jonathan, D-Laser, Andy, Paul, Mike, and Brad. If you want to join their ranks, head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. All right. That wraps it up for us. Folks, if you want to email me, TheYoungAmerican@gmail.com. You can sign up for my free political newsletter at FreePoliticalNewsletter.com. You can follow me on any and all platforms at Justin R. Young. Till next time, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, telling you that politics has three names. And I saw somebody that was talking about politics. I saw somebody else that was talking about politics. And I heard somebody out there in the UK talking about politics. But this is the only show that talks about
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.